turn your Bibles to Luke, the 18th chapter. We'll get there in just a few minutes. Luke, the 18th chapter, will be the text that we'll use. Recently, I read that if you ever find yourself in a situation where you've been buried alive, there's one crucial piece of advice. And here it is. Spit first and dig second. Spit first and dig second. And the reason that's crucial is because it turns out the biggest mistake people make when they've been buried alive is trying to dig out without knowing which direction to dig. If you dig in the wrong direction, you'll dig yourself deeper into the hole, right? So when you're covered with dirt or snow or something like that, it's nearly impossible to know which direction leads to the way out. But gravity still applies. Gravity still applies. So if possible, try to push a little dirt or snow, whatever you're covered with, away from your face and spit. And if the spit falls directly away from you, you're facing down. You got to turn around somehow. If the spit falls to the left or to the right, you're sideways. If the spit falls back in your face, the good news is you're facing up. Start digging. You see, when a person spits, he knows up from down. Well, how does this relate to our spiritual lives? What kind of sense can we make of that? When Jesus began his teaching ministry, there was a lot of directional confusion by people in the world. Up seemed like down to many people. And as people were trying to find the light, they only dug themselves deeper into the darkness. And so for many people, what Jesus taught was perplexing and didn't appear to provide any clarity to the direction they should go. Jesus came along and he taught that the way down was up, and the way up was down. For example, he would say in Matthew 5 and verse 5, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. When we view something like that through our 21st century lens, it seems all backwards. The meek will inherit the earth. I mean, isn't it the high-profile people in this world, the TV personalities, the movie stars, the professional athletes, the wealthy people? Isn't it those people who are inheriting the earth? And among those folks, the word humble doesn't typically come to mind. The meek will inherit the earth. But you see, Jesus invites us to think differently than the world because he wants to lead us down the path to real life, where there's true fulfillment and true blessings. If you remember in previous lessons like this, we've talked about how these kinds of things and other teachings of Jesus were often not only countercultural, but they were also counterintuitive and still are, sometimes even to us as the people of God. Sometimes his teachings are perceived as radical, but to those who are trying to be humble, these things are understood. And they produce contentment and hope. Jesus is teaching about an alternative to the way the world thinks about how life should be lived. To the world, most folks would view success by status and power and wealth and relationships to people who have those kinds of things. The world approaches life from the perspective of every man for himself. Do whatever it takes to get yourself as close to the top as you can, regardless of what it does to others in the process. But the alternative way of Jesus says that up is down. And Luke, the 18th chapter, Jesus teaches a parable to show us the difference between his way and the world's way. Luke 18, begin with me in verse 10. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be abased, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. But Jesus began the parable by saying two men went up to the temple to pray. It sounds like two guys stand together and say, hey, did you hear the one about two men going up to the temple to pray? But to Jesus, this is no joke. It's a story of two men, one being a Pharisee, the other the tax collector. Now, what we know about the Pharisees is that they were greatly concerned about the religious compromise of the Jewish people in their day. In fact, they were so concerned about law keeping that they created new laws to keep people from breaking the laws of God. So here was a law of God. We'll just put a hedge around it. We'll make another law or two or three to keep you from breaking the law of God. You have to break these laws before you can break the law of God. Now, these new laws or traditions, as Jesus called them in Matthew 15, became elevated to the same status as the law of God, so that if you broke a law of the Pharisees, it was a consideration, considered a violation of God's law in their mind. And so people looked up to these Pharisees because they were perceived as being committed to the law. They were educated. They were influential. We today would probably, if we lived back then, would have placed them at the top of the social ladder in that culture. The other man in the story, though, is the tax collector, equivalent perhaps to a modern-day IRS agent who was part of the mafia. Not only did he collect taxes for the Roman government, but he also collected extra for his own needs, for his own well-being, to line his own pockets. Basically, a legalized thief that we would place today at the bottom of the social ladder in that culture. So, of these two guys who walked up to the temple, one, if you had young children, one is you would point out to this guy and you'd say, this is what you want to be like when you grow up. And to the other, you'd say, oh, you don't want to be like this guy when you grow up. And notice who Jesus was speaking to on this occasion. Verse 9. He spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. When you hear statements like that referring to people, other people, do you think of words like smug or condescending? When you hear a similar story today, do you ever hear the story of someone being smug or condescending and you think of yourself in that description? No. None of us ever think of ourselves as those who are righteous in their own eyes, despising others. We always think of someone else who fits that description. It's never us, right? You know, many years ago, I preached a sermon on one Sunday morning about the duty of wives in marriage, and an older couple making their way out, and the man in front of the wife, and he said, that was a good lesson. He said, I was telling the old lady about that the other night. Well, first of all, side note, if you're ever married or ever will be married, please never refer to your spouse as the old lady or the old man, one or the other. Profaning the union that God has put in place. But for that matter, he just didn't get it at all, did he? In his mind, the message didn't apply to him any at all. And better yet, he had no clue that that night I was preaching on the duty of husbands in marriage. But I suppose it's just human nature for us to be blind to our own faults, blind to our own needs, things that we need to improve on or work on. You ever been in a situation where somebody's teaching or preaching and you hear a point that you think, man, that probably steps on some toes, and you're thinking, man, I hope he or she really hears that because they could use that. They didn't make some changes in their lives. And it just flies right over our head. We don't ever make the examination to our own lives. Instead of examining ourselves, we just assume the lesson is for someone else to hear. It can't be for us, right? Country singer Kenny Rogers has, I don't know if he wrote the song, but he sings a song called I Am the Greatest. I don't know if you've ever heard it or not. If you haven't, go listen to it on YouTube this afternoon. And this song is about a little boy who's playing baseball by himself. He stands in the field with his ball and bat, and he says, I am the greatest player of them all. He puts his bat on his shoulder and he tosses up the ball. And the ball goes up and the ball comes down. He swings his bat all the way around and the ball falls to the ground. The little boy doesn't say a word. Picks up his bat, picks up his ball, he's undeterred. He says, "I am the greatest there has ever been." And he grits his teeth and tries again. The ball goes up, the ball comes down, and he swings his bat all the way around. And the baseball falls to the ground. He makes no excuses. He shows no fears. He just closes his eyes and listens to the cheers. He picks up his ball, stares at his bat, and says, "I am the greatest. The game is on the line." And he gives his all one last time. And the ball goes up like the moon so bright, swings his bat with all his might, and the baseball falls to the ground, and that's strike three. And now it's supper time, and his mama calls. So the little boy starts home with his bat and ball and says, "I am the greatest, that is a fact. But even I didn't know I could pitch like that." Final line, he says, "I am the greatest that is understood, but even I didn't know I could pitch that good." You know, it makes a humorous story, and it kind of makes us laugh. But I'll tell you what, you don't want to be like this little boy in life. It's one thing to be undeterred and not let failure break us, but it's altogether different when we're too arrogant to see our own faults and our own needs. See, the problem with arrogance is it keeps us from getting to the end of ourselves, and it prevents us from living the abundant life that Jesus wants us to live. C.S. Lewis once said, "Humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less." Isn't that so true? Humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. That's where we need to be. Now, as we get back to the parable, Jesus again says that two men went up to the temple to pray. And the Pharisee is one who's praying boastfully about himself, declaring his righteousness to God. Notice in verse 11, did you notice he begins his prayer with a thanks? A thank you? The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, "God, I thank you." That seems like a very good way to start a prayer, is be thankful for God, for your blessings from God. But in this case, the Pharisee identifies himself as the blessing. "I thank you that I am not like other people." And to make himself look better, he compares himself to all the vile sinners around him, the extortioners, the unjust, the adulterers, and even this tax collector. Now again, we know the Pharisees were legalistic rule followers who often held others to a higher standard than themselves. It's that whole "do as I say, not as I do" mentality. They were focused on performance and how they appeared to others. Matthew 23:5, Jesus says, "All their works they do to be seen by men." He called them hypocrites. One writer said, "People loved and admired the Pharisees, so the Pharisees loved and admired themselves." They bought their own hype, and they missed the greatest miracle in human history. I mean, consider the fact that the Messiah was right with them, standing right before them, and they couldn't even recognize him. And they were surrounded by people in their world like we are today, with many physical and spiritual needs, but the things they cared about did not intersect with the things God cared about. And that's perhaps the most powerful point of this whole lesson. We need to examine our own lives today. Are we people who care about the things that God cares about? Because this problem is still alive and well today, with people don't care about the things of God. And so we need to be extremely careful in our lives that we don't become like the Pharisees and overlook the mission of God in our lives. We need to learn from their failure by recognizing the danger of focusing on appearances. And that's admittedly difficult because it's our human nature to be concerned about what others think about us. But when we're too concerned about what others think about us, here's the problem. Our faith tends to become more about what we do that others can see instead of about the heart behind our actions. Well, one might ask, how then do we know if our heart is right and our actions are based on humility? How can we know? One person has suggested we use the analogy of comparisons. Here's the way it works. If you're interested in becoming a better person, if you're interested in becoming better at your job or whatever you're trying to achieve, Who do you measure yourself against? Well, you look for someone who inspires you, right? You look for someone who could teach you a thing or two about whatever it is you're wanting to do or trying to accomplish or wanting to be. This is called comparing up. Now, if you have an issue with pride, you're not going to compare up when you make comparisons. Now, you'll compare yourself to others, but you would compare yourself to people who would make you feel better about yourself. And that's comparing down. And in the Pharisee in Luke, the 18th chapter, it looks to me like it's comparing down because he wants God to see him in the best possible light. I thank you that I'm not like other men. He doesn't look to other spiritual leaders. He doesn't look to the Old Testament prophets, the great people of faith of old. He compares himself to the worst of society. He compares down. And I'll tell you, comparing down is a trap of the devil because it causes us to have a false view of ourselves. We become performance oriented and we measure our faithfulness on how we compare with others. And the truth of the matter is, you can always find someone who's worse than you, lower than yourselves. Now, that's a trap. Now, I tell you, I don't know about your experience, but mine as being raised in the Church of Christ, I think we've been taught in so many cases this kind of religion. It went something like this. Let's keep ourselves pure. Let's be morally upright. But whatever you do, don't associate with sinners. Well, isn't that comparing down? Finding those who are worse than we are, or we think of ourselves, and then we think better of ourselves than we really are. We conclude that we're righteous. But it's a trick of the devil. Don't be tricked into comparing down. Now, as far as this Pharisee goes, for five times in the parable, he uses the first person pronoun, I. I thank you that I'm not like other men. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. We would say that this guy is full of himself. I mean, consider just for one example of what he uses, that according to Leviticus chapter 16, 29 through 31, the law of Moses commanded fasting one day a year. One day a year. And what's he say? I fast twice a week, Lord. That's more than 100 times more than what God commanded. Do you suppose God wanted that from the Pharisee? Do you think that's what God wants from us? An external religion? Warren Wiersbe says, the great sin of the Pharisees was hypocrisy based on pride. Their religion was external, not internal. It was to impress people, not to please God. They bound people with heavy burdens, and while Christ came to set people free, they loved titles and public recognition and exalted themselves at the expense of others. But in contrast, when we look at the prayer of the tax collector, we see a much different picture. The Pharisee is described as one who's full of himself. The tax collector is described as one who is at the end of himself. He is exactly where Jesus wants you and I to be. The end of ourselves. Don't you find it interesting in this parable that Jesus mentions the body language of both men? The Pharisee stood and prayed, implication where he could be seen. He was at the temple, verse 11. But the tax collector, who stood afar off, he stands at a distance, wouldn't even look up to heaven and beat his breast. God be merciful to me, I'm a sinner. He recognizes his unworthiness before God. He isn't someone who appears to just be going through the motions. This is not external to him. It's internal. The tax collector has come to the temple to be in the presence of God, and no one else matters right now. He stands alone to offer himself to God and to talk with God with the understanding of who he is and who God is. Madeline L. Ingalls said, humility is throwing oneself away in complete concentration on something or someone else. Humility is throwing oneself away in complete concentration on something or someone else. This tax collector is broken. He's humbled by the majesty of God, and all he can do here is plead for mercy and grace as he confesses his sin. Dear friends, he shows us what getting to the end of ourselves looks like. This is what we ought to be. At the end of the parable, Jesus explains again, the way up is down, and the way down is up. Verse 14, he said, for everyone who exalts himself will be abased, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, the last observation I want to make to you from this text is that Jesus says we must humble ourselves. Humble ourselves. You know, being humbled is something I think we often think of as a passive activity. What I mean by that is somebody or something humbles us. For example, I lose my job, I'm humbled by unemployment. My relationship with someone else disintegrates and fails. I'm humbled by a failed relationship. I make bad choices in life. I'm humbled by the consequences of bad choices. That's a passive thing. But it seems to me here that Jesus speaks of a humbling that is active, where it's us. We are the humblers. We humble ourselves. This isn't something we wait for, but it's something we pursue. We proactively seek it. And why would we do this? Well, perhaps this is the answer to the pride problem in the world and in our lives. Jesus shows us, by his own example, if you look over in Philippians, the second chapter, what Paul said there about Jesus in verse 6 through 8, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a servant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death of the cross. He made himself nothing. Equal with God, yet didn't cling to that status. He humbled himself. Now that seems to create a new paradox. How is it that we can humble ourselves without becoming proud of our humility? Well, two brief suggestions and the lesson's yours. How can we humble ourselves without becoming proud of our humility? Well, first of all, to humble ourselves, we must voluntarily confess our sin. It has to be done voluntarily. If I confess my sin because I got caught, well, I'm humbled, but I'm not necessarily humbling myself. If I confess my sin because I've been confronted, I'm humbled, but I'm not necessarily humbling myself. So voluntary confession is a way of humbling myself, and God exalts those who do so. And the second suggestion about how to humble ourselves without becoming proud of our humility is to treat others better than ourselves. That's a stark contrast to the way of the world today, the me-first way of the world today that teaches us to be self-reliant and look out for ourselves first before any other. Philippians 2 and verse 3, in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. And so again, this is about getting to the end of ourselves. If I want to humble myself, I need to find some people that most people would expect them to serve me, and I serve them. Jesus said the way up is down when he said, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now, at the beginning of the lesson, I said, if you're ever buried alive, you need to spit first and dig second in order to determine the direction that you need to dig. And so let me ask you, dear friend, are you heading in the right direction in your life so that heaven is your hope? It's awfully easy to head in the wrong direction and not know it. Let me illustrate. I want you to help me with something here real quick before we end. I want every one of you to close your eyes for me. Close your eyes. And then I want you to point to the direction that you think is north. Point north. Close your eyes and point north. Not much participation here. Need some pointers. Need to see some fingers. Point north. Don't be afraid. Keep your eyes closed. Keep pointing forward. Now open your eyes and look around. See all those who failed us. First of all, look around and see where people are pointing. Some of you are right, some of you are wrong. North is this way. Some of you are pointing that way, but many of you are pointing totally opposite, different directions. And how were you wrong? Why were you wrong? Because you didn't use the same standard. You didn't use the true standard, a compass. I looked ahead of time. It's that way. If you aren't using the true standard of God's Scripture to give direction to your life, then you're heading in the wrong direction. And it takes humility to admit you're wrong and change direction in your life. But this is the way of the kingdom of God. God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. For anyone here this morning who needs help receiving the grace of God today, come in humility and God will lift you up. Come now.